To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio of the Working Class, by the Working Class, for the Working Class. I'm Jamie Partridge, your host this evening. Tonight I'll be reading excerpts from Secrets of a Successful Organizer, a book by Labor Notes, available at labornotes.org. Lesson 1, Attitude Adjustment. You're reading this. That means you're interested in organizing where you work. You want to fix problems you see around you. Maybe something unfair has happened to you or to someone you work with, and you want to do something about it. For us, that's organizing. For the boss, that's trouble. People who try to do something, especially when they bring others together to do something collectively, are often labeled troublemakers. But we suggest you wear the word with pride. From Mother Jones to Martin Luther King Jr., the best organizers have been reviled as troublemakers because they were bringing people together and building strength in numbers that threatened the power of the few. Organizing is a lot like cooking. There are time-tested recipes that anyone can learn, methods that work, and some that don't. Your results may not be perfect every time, since we're dealing with human beings here, but you will do better if you learn from the successes and mistakes of the organizers who have gone before you. Example, stopping harassment. In a meatpacking plant in Pasco, Washington, management had had its way for years. Conditions were dangerous, floors were slippery, and harassment was a constant. The union was weak. Very few members were involved. But that all began to change when a few workers decided to organize their co-workers to make their work life more tolerable. One of their first steps was to hold meetings in the cafeteria for people who worked on each production line. Anyone willing to attend could help make plans to deal with their worst shop floor problems. Quote, the company wasn't happy about our meetings, said Maria Martinez, the chief steward. They started sending supervisors to listen to us. They said we weren't allowed to hold union meetings in their cafeteria. I told them that the National Labor Relations Act gives us the right to organize and to hold meetings in non-work areas at non-work times. Management told me to put it in writing, so I did. I wrote a grievance and had 100 people sign it. That was the last I heard from management about that, and we kept on meeting in the cafeteria. Unquote. A comic topic at the meetings was harassment, so volunteers on each production line began training their co-workers to document the harassment and encouraging them to stand up to it. Martina said, if a supervisor said something, we'd say real loud to other people on the line, did you hear what he just said? When incidents piled up, members would go as a group to higher level managers. They prepared in advance to tell their stories so that one person wouldn't stick out doing all the talking. The actions worked. Supervisors, perhaps to avoid friction with their own bosses, started to back off. To keep supervisors in check, another tactic the workers used was grievance forms, modeled after disciplinary tickets. Workers could write up their supervisors by checking off violations. Usually all the people from one line would sit down and document the harassment together. One copy went to the offending supervisor, one to the union, and one to management. Organizing is an attitude. Organizing is, first of all, an attitude. It's the attitude that you and your coworkers together can do something to make things better. It's the attitude that action is better than complaining. It's the attitude that problems are just waiting for a solution and that strength in numbers is part of that solution. It's the refusal to be discouraged, at least not for long. It's the willingness to listen to others with respect so that the plan you come up with reflects the good ideas of many people. If you have the organizing attitude, you feel it's necessary to respond to unfairness. You are committed to building power with your coworkers, not just talking about it. You believe in collective action and want to get better at putting others in motion. The organizing attitude. Action is better than complaining. Problems are waiting for solutions. Solutions are collective, not individual. People can be brought together to make things better. Organizing is for everyone. Though this book was written with union members in mind, many of its lessons apply in non-union workplaces too. But be careful, especially about acting alone. If you don't have a union, management can get rid of you for a bogus reason or no reason at all. You'll find more safety and strength in numbers. Consider contacting a union for help. Apathy isn't real. The first attitude adjustment an organizer needs to get over the idea that coworkers don't care, that your workplace is bogged down in apathy. It's a common gripe. In Knit Labor Notes workshops, we often ask union members to make a list of the reasons why people don't get involved where they work. Typical answers include lack of time, don't know how to do it, the union's not open, there's no easy way in, conflicts between groups, conflicts between individuals, my coworkers feel that nothing will change, they think everyone else is apathetic, they're looking for individual solutions, and the big one, fear. Sound familiar? It might feel like your coworkers don't care, but push a little bit and that's never really true. Everyone cares about something at work. Just about everyone cares about their wages, for instance. Everyone wants respect. No one's indifferent to whether their shift is miserable. It's impossible not to care. Could it be that your workplace is the one in a million where everything's fine? Maybe your coworkers are completely secure about their jobs, love their supervisors, make excellent money with terrific benefits, have no worries about downsizing or layoffs, face no health hazards, and are confident about their retirement. If so, put down this book and get another hobby. But it's more likely that people are scared to say anything or feel powerless. They might say everything is fine because they don't believe it can change, or they can't imagine it being different, or they assume the problem they care about isn't a union issue. Organizing is the antidote. Remember Maria Martinez's coworkers at the meatpacking plant? Most had never been to a union meeting, but they did care that their supervisors were harassing them. They just didn't think that they could do anything about it. Once I saw people organizing to tackle the problem, they wanted to get involved. So when you're assessing why more people haven't stepped up to take on the boss, it's important to find out the actual reasons. You have to diagnose the problem before you can write the prescription. It's not apathy, but what is it? Step back from your frustration and look at the things from an organizing perspective. This chart shows 5 common problems and how you can help your coworkers get past them. And here's a chart. How the boss keeps us disorganized. The boss relies on fear, hopelessness, division, confusion, inaction. The boss relies on fear of conflict and retaliation. The boss relies on hopelessness, the feeling that things can't change and we have no power. The boss relies on division, pitting workers against each other. The boss relies on confusion, passing around messages that will alarm or distract us. The boss relies on inaction, since problems can't be solved, so why bother? The organizer taps into righteous anger about workplace injuries, and coworkers find the courage and determination to act and overcome fear. The organizer helps develop a plan to win and shares examples of victories elsewhere. And coworkers find hope that change is possible and worth fighting for, overcoming hopelessness. How to overcome division. The organizer identifies common ground and builds relationships. Coworkers find unity to act together. How to overcome confusion. The organizer interprets and shares information, fitting it into a larger picture. And coworkers find clarity to see through the boss's plan. How to overcome inaction. The organizer mobilizes coworkers to do something together. That action gets results and solves problems. What's the real problem? Here are some ways to understand what looks like apathy and respond to it. No one seems to care. Everyone cares about something. But the something might not be what you expect. Pick out a few coworkers you'd like to know better. Make a point of talking to them. Find out what's on their mind. Maybe the drug testing policy that's grinding your gears isn't at the top of their list because something else is bugging them more. A foul chemical in the air, a mean supervisor, a toothache and no dental plan, a shift that means they hardly get to see their kids, being forced to defend a stupid policy to customers. The only way to find out is to ask and listen. Someone who's facing sexual harassment, for example, might feel strongly about it, but she might assume that it's not your issue and not a union issue. Show your coworkers respect and understanding. When they feel that from you, they're more likely to respect the things you care about. It's hard to see how things could change. Maybe your coworkers are just as bugged by the drug testing policy as you are, but it seems too big to tackle. The boss has done a good job of cementing the idea that the decision is final, and fighting it sounds like a waste of time. It's perfectly reasonable that people feel this way, especially if they've always felt powerless and disorganized at work. People are used to going along to get along. If your coworkers have never felt strength in numbers or seen a group take action to change even something small, why would they believe they could change something big? As an organizer, it's your job to inspire your coworkers that change is possible if you work together. Part of this is developing a credible plan to win. Ask, what solution are we proposing? Who in management has the authority to say yes? What could we do together to get that person to say yes? Share stories of tactics that have worked elsewhere. Often it helps to start small. Involving your coworkers in a tiny campaign that gets results is a way to show, not tell, them that collective action has power. Look for fights you can win with the people you have on board so far, taking just a small step out of their comfort zone. When it works, more people will be drawn in. As they participate, their confidence will grow, and you can go farther each time. Hopelessness can be a strong habit. It's easier to break a habit with group support. Bringing people together can help individuals get past their discouragement. No one's willing to do anything. Have you asked them personally to do something specific? Most of us aren't natural-born organizers. Many of your coworkers don't and won't initiate activity, but they might respond, if asked directly, by someone they trust. Figure out some very small, specific requests and personally approach a coworker. At first, it might be as simple as answering a survey, coming to lunch with other coworkers to discuss a problem, or signing a group letter. Be respectful of time constraints in their lives. Show lots of appreciation for anything they're willing to do, and make it clear that any victories were won by the whole team. This attitude of respect will encourage them to do more in the future. No one comes to meetings. Think about how people are notified about meetings. An email or a notice on the bulletin board isn't enough. Personal, face-to-face invitations are the best. Divide up your workplace and find several other people to share the work of inviting people individually. Also consider the practical things that could make meetings more accessible. Scheduling, location, childcare, translation, transportation. When people do come to a meeting, it had better be pleasant and productive, or they won't be back. People are incredibly busy these days, and you can fake respect for their participation by planning the meeting ahead of time. Prepare a clear agenda, a time limit, and a reason to attend, such as a hot issue. If a meeting is just to get information, it's easy to skip it. People will be more motivated to attend a meeting where they have a meaningful role to play, for instance, to help make an action plan. If you miss that meeting, there's a consequence. The plan will be made without your input. All that said, sometimes people simply can't make it to meetings, for instance, because of parenting responsibilities. These people can still play a crucial role in organizing while they're at work. Be flexible.
If you just tuned in, this is KBOO Portland. You're listening to Labor Radio and excerpts from Secrets of a Successful Organizer.
Aim for the bullseye. If you ask union members to draw their union structure, most will draw a pyramid. Officers at the top, rank and file at the bottom. Some might get clever and draw an inverted pyramid with the rank and file at the top. But a better way to think about your fellow members from the organizer's point of view is like a dartboard with concentric circles. In the center is your core group, the people, maybe you, who are always thinking about organizing and how to get others involved, even in on their time off. They may be elected leaders or shop stewards or not. In the first ring are the activists who can be counted on to help when the issue heats up. They will take responsibility to get the word out and will ask other people to take action too. In the second ring are supporters, people who will wear a button or sign a petition, but don't take responsibility for getting anyone else involved. And in the third ring are the people who appear most disengaged. They don't see the union as a factor in their lives, so they don't participate. There are also people outside the circle who aren't just uninvolved, they're hostile to the union. Don't waste your time arguing with the haters. Maybe one day something will open their eyes, but it'll probably be an experience and not a debate that does it. You're different, and that's okay. It's crucial for the organizer to understand that the concentration of coworkers in the outer rings isn't a sign of failure. Most of your coworkers won't ever become dedicated union volunteers day in and day out. Even in winning campaigns, the planning, the strategizing, and a fair share of the grunt work are typically carried out by a handful of members, the core group. The activists and supporters join in as needed, and a lot of people who are usually disengaged play a part when the stakes get highest, for example, during a strike. Don't set the bar too high. You can't send a message that to be involved in the union, people have to be like you. They will shy away. Making a meaningful contribution shouldn't require devoting all their days and nights. Instead, help everyone to find their own levels of involvement. And as you take on different fights, don't be surprised when people move between roles, sometimes acting as leaders, sometimes hanging back. But you probably do need more people to join you in the core group and more supporters to step up as activists. Union veterans will tell you that a good goal as one activist is one activist or steward for every 10 workers, including at least one on every shift and in every department or work area. Your organizing task is, how are you going to move more people toward the center of the bullseye? Help them take one step at a time, moving from being disengaged to supportive, and from support to activism, or from activism to taking on core responsibilities. Never make your core group an exclusive club. Don't be a hero. The Lone Ranger was not an organizer. As an organizer, you can't be a superhero or a firefighter, even if you are a firefighter. Your role isn't to knock the door down, burst in, and rescue people. It's to build a team of activists. Guard against the impulse to put yourself at the center of everything the union is doing. As the great civil rights activist Ella Baker said, we need more movement-centered leaders, not leader-centered movements. This attitude adjustment can be challenging since many of us are motivated by a strong sense of injustice. You're outraged at the petty slights the supervisor dishes out. You don't want to let the problem go a moment longer. But a good organizer taps into that righteous anger in others, motivates people to take collective action, and gives them the experience of bringing about change together. That's how you build power at work and develop leadership. This is particularly hard because your coworkers often expect you to be the hero. They are comfortable letting you take all the risks, but they won't learn to help themselves or help each other if you do everything for them. So when a coworker comes to you with a problem, instead of tying on your cape, look for ways you can help her to get the ball rolling herself. This is a box at the bottom of a page. Troublemakers can't be slackers at work. Do your job consistently and do it well. Don't make yourself an easy target for management. Coworkers will respect you more too. Try to recruit people who are good at their jobs into your core group of organizers. It's all about power. In any workplace, the underlying issue is power. Who has it, who wants it, and how it's used. Power is the whole ball of wax, says Hedy Rosenstein, who headed a local of public workers in New Jersey for many years. Yet many people are uncomfortable with power. They find it hard to talk about and are reluctant to seek it. People shy away from the conflict and the unpleasantness it implies. People want to believe that if we're fair and we're brilliant, then we'll get what's right, Rosenstein observes. But it isn't enough. You can't just empower yourself. You have to take it away from management. Organizers need to understand that what makes it hard for people to push for power. Then you can help them take the first step. When training Chicago teachers to organize their co-workers, organizer Matthew Luskin starts with a discussion of power. What is it? Is it good or bad? Where does it come from? Who has it? He asks, what would we do if we had all the power in the world? The group brainstorms a list: affordable housing for all, free health care, no more wars, education instead of prisons. Without warning, Luskin slips into a role play. He writes power on a piece of paper and holds it up over his head. Well, this is a nice list that you've all made, he tells the group, but I have all the power, and I have a few issues with it. Channeling a corporate executive, politician, and obnoxious supervisor rolled into one, he starts ridiculing their list and crossing things off. Healthcare, all you have to do is pay me for it. I own some great insurance companies and hospitals. Why would I want free higher education? Well, this is ridiculous. Luskin can carry on this tirade indefinitely. He won't stop until a group of people stands up, chases him down, and snatches the paper labeled power out of his hands. People figure out pretty quickly what's going on. Often someone pipes up to say, we all need to take the power from him. But still, it's usually a long time after that before people get up the nerve to do it. Afterwards, they talk about why it took so long. People were embarrassed. They didn't want to look stupid. They were afraid of being the first to act. They weren't sure other people would back them up. These concerns are universal, and Luskin emphasizes they're perfectly reasonable. Fighting for power is risky and uncomfortable, especially at first. What gets people through it? Having a plan, seeing someone else take a risk, and finding safety in numbers. Know your rights. Justin West worked at the Mitsubishi plant in Normal, Illinois. He tells how he and his coworkers spoke truth to power. After one area of the plant went through a week of blatant contract violations by managers, workers talked about strategies and settled on a plan. One night on second shift, a majority of the workers in the area taped 8.5 by 11 signs to their backs bearing messages such as pride, respect, dignity, stop walking on the contract, I have rights. Upper managers got wind of it within minutes and demanded that the signs be removed. The workers protested and held their ground. Labor relations was called down. After 20 minutes of battling, management threatened disciplinary actions against everyone. The workers did remove their signs under protest, but notified management that labor board charges would follow. The next day, the union received a settlement in its favor on one of the major grievances the workers were protesting: short notice mandatory overtime. Your legal rights to organize. It's helpful for an organizer to know what protections you have under U.S. labor law. Enforcing your basic rights can be a good way to show your coworkers that the boss isn't all-powerful. The law is not a silver bullet. Some of its protections and penalties are weak, and court cases can drag on for years. Still, it's an important tool in your kit. Often you don't have to go to court to enforce the law. Simply knowing and asserting your rights can have a powerful effect. Remembering the meatpacking plant? Remember the meatpacking plant described at the beginning of this lesson? Managers objected to union meetings in the cafeteria, but workers knew the law was on their side. After 100 people signed a grievance saying so, managers backed off. On the job. Most private sector workers' rights on the job are protected by a federal law, the National Labor Relations Act. It doesn't cover agricultural workers, domestic workers, independent contractors or supervisors. Airline and railway workers are covered by a separate similar law, the Railway Labor Act. Concerted activity. The NLRA, National Labor Relations Act, protects your right to engage in, quote, concerted activities for the purpose of a collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection, unquote. In other words, to take action with at least one other person to improve conditions at work. Protected concerted activities include filing grievances, complaining about contract violations, holding rank and file meetings, visiting the boss in a group on non-work time, petitioning, wearing buttons, and other ways of pressuring the boss. You have these rights whether or not there's a union at your workplace. Management or union officials may not harass you by spying on you or interrogating you about rank and file meetings or other protected activities. Neither your employer nor your union may lawfully discipline you for exercising your rights. Bargaining and strikes. Some rights are different depending on whether or not you're in a union. In a union workplace, the employer is obligated to bargain with the union and to answer information requests. There's no such obligation in a non-union workplace. On the other hand, non-union workers have the right to strike at will, though this is taking a big risk. Union members are usually bound by contract language not to strike until the contract expires. And here's a box. But what if I work in the public sector? If you work for the government, you're not covered by the NLRA, National Labor Relations Act, unless you're a Postal Service employee. But most public employers are covered by federal or state laws modeled on the NLRA. You can find the law for federal employees at FLRA, Federal Labor Relations Act, FLRA.gov/statute, and the state laws at bit.ly/stateunionlaws. Government workers also have free speech protections under the First Amendment if they are speaking about matters of public concern. That's in addition to any union contract protections. Distributing literature. You may distribute leaflets at work in non-work areas on non-work time. Non-work areas include the parking lot, the time clock, the cafeteria, or anywhere people go on break outside the work area. Soliciting signatures on a petition may be done in working areas on non-work time as long as no literature is passed out. You may use company-provided general use bulletin boards to post literature and notices. If workers can post things like cartoons, event flyers, or order forms for Girl Scout cookies, it's a general use bulletin board. Rules that forbid posting union-related literature or that the boss creates it in response to a union or rank-and-file activity are illegal. The National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, may allow employers to prohibit the distribution of literature that criticizes the employer's product or services in a way unrelated to labor issues if the primary target of that literature is the customer base or the general public. Online. Internet conversations between coworkers, such as Facebook posts, tweets, or blogs, get the same protections as face-to-face conversations about wages, hours, and working conditions. If your rights are violated, you may file a charge at the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board. If the regional office decides your case has merit, it will schedule a hearing and provide a lawyer to prosecute it. Your charge must be filed within 6 months of the date your rights are violated. But remember, the wheels of justice turn slowly. When in doubt, think like an organizer, not like a lawyer. In the union. If your union includes private sector workers, your rights inside the union are protected by the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act. If your union represents exclusively public sector workers, the laws vary by state. Okay. In the union. Free speech. You have the right to meet, organize, and speak freely. Union officials may not disrupt rank-and-file meetings or distribution of literature. You have the right to speak at union meetings subject to reasonable rules, such as Robert's Rules of Order. Elections. You have the right to equal opportunity to vote, nominate candidates, and run for union office. You have the right to secret ballot vote on increases in local union dues, initiation fees, and assessments. Contracts. You have the right to receive, upon request, to your local, a copy of your contract and the right to inspect all contracts that your local administers. Union financial statements. Every private sector union must file an annual financial statement with the U.S. Department of Labor containing officer salaries, expenses, and other union expenses and income. The report, known as the LM2, LM3, or LM4, depending on the union's size, is a public document and can be obtained online at bit.ly/union search, capital U, capital S. Defending your rights. Unfortunately, the law is nothing more than words on paper unless you can enforce it. A good resource for actually enforcing your rights is the Association for Union Democracy. Visit its website at uniondemocracy.org.
That wraps it up for this evening's Labor Radio, this Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. I'm Jamie Partridge, your host. We've been reading excerpts from Secrets of a Successful Organizer. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.